This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
So there have been several proposals for economic and social reform in Aboriginal Australia based on establishing natural resource management-based economies. But what are they? Basically, NRM-based economies are generate economic returns from the stock of natural and cultural resources for the benefits of the holder, so they have an economic incentive to maintain them. Economic returns are generated from trading environmental goods and services to local and non-local buyers or actors, NGOs, government, businesses, you name it. They have the potential to address economic growth and conservation. They are kind of, on paper, they look very good because they focus on an integrated approach. Indeed, in the last... why are we talking about NRM-based economies? Well, you surely are aware that Australia's the last decades has experienced a substantial economic growth. But in terms of social economic well-being and opportunities, several studies indicate that, for instance, in terms of regional indicators, there has been much of an income convergence. So inequality, income inequality is still there, at least up until 2001. More recent studies indeed also show that even if income inequality has been decreasing since 2000, relative poverty has increased. And relative poverty is defined as the number of people living on less than 50% of the median income. And this poverty threshold is really important when we talk about Indigenous people because Indigenous median income is only 59% of the non-Indigenous population. That means that at least 50% of Indigenous people live in poverty or very close to the poverty threshold. And also we know that on a range of indicators, child mortality, employment, education, health, Indigenous people and non-Indigenous people are quite different. But also economic growth in Australia in general around the world has proceeded alongside major environmental transformation. In Australia, we know that at least half of ecosystems, especially in coastal areas and in the Murray-Darley Basin, are under severe pressure and in decline. And 39% of Australian bioregions are under threat. Also, we know that Australia is ranks among the highest CO2 emitters and energy use, and then among the energy users. Also, the recent drought has exposed the severe water allocation problems and the vulnerability to changing climate condition. And indeed, the IPCC predicts serious loss of biodiversity in Australia and increasing water security problems and declining productivity in agriculture and forestry. So this is basically, on one side, we have concern about the environment, the conditions of the environment. On the other, we have the limited best results in terms of poverty reduction and income inequality reduction. So these two elements are the basic rationale behind the idea of NRM-based economies. And indeed, in the past 20 years, there have been several programs that have tried to tackle, on one side, declining living standard in rural Australia and a decline also of the environment. The major program on a national level were the National Land Care Program, the National Heritage Trust, and the National Action Plan on Salinity and Water Quality. They were all based on the rationale that they should help capacity building to increase NRM awareness and produce a kind of environmental stewardship ethics. And they mainly target basically sustainability at the farm landscape level, and basically they try to promote sustainable agriculture use and sustainable use of vegetation, water, and land. And for some programs, farmers join in large numbers, and it basically managed to set up a set of networks between farmers. Community groups and government and businesses. Basically over the life of these programs, they have used 4.5 billion of taxpayer money. There is a general, however, understanding that these programs haven't been successful at all. They have increased NRM awareness. Indeed, around 40% of farmers across Australia have joined one or more than these programs, one or two of these programs. But, however, they mostly have driven this program for the provision of services for production activities. And basically, no environmental changes has been reported yet. And so it's basically fairly inefficient use of taxpayer money. And also there was a lack of scientific inputs to solve environmental problems that, to some degree, like salinity, are quite complex. In terms of indigenous engagement, also these programs have performed quite poorly. In terms of indigenous participation and access to funds, you know, this doesn't happen much. In terms of indigenous NRM, the major national program that I'm aware of is the Indigenous Protected Areas Program. It was established in 1996 as part of Australia's commitment to set up the National Reserve System and then meet Australia's obligation under Article 8 of the International Convention on Biological Conservation. Indigenous protected areas basically are Aboriginal land, Aboriginal homeland, the traditional owners, over which traditional owners have entered a voluntary agreement with the federal government for the protection of biodiversity and conservation of indigenous culture. Currently, there are 33 IPAs, declared IPAs. There are over 40 that are in process, and overall, they contribute to 23% of the National Reserve System. In this slide, I've collected some basic information from a sample of declared Indigenous Protected Areas. What's important to note here is that in terms of financial commitment from the government, all this land, the millions of hectares that traditional owners have donated to the National Reserve System hasn't required any financial commitment from the government so far. Further, for some of the land that has been purchased by or returned to traditional owners, this land was previously used for pastoral or agricultural use, so it was highly degraded. So the traditional owners have taken on themselves to restore and to care for the country, again, with very little financial commitment from the government, from the federal government. Indigenous or IPAs are usually reputed a very successful story of collaboration with traditional owners and the government. And indeed, from the point of view of Australia, they have acquired very significant land in terms of biodiversity in a very cost-effective way, so with minimal expenditure. For the traditional owner, IPAs basically are ways to pursue some social, economic, and cultural goals, and are there to say that to some degree, at least in my experience with IPAs, they have managed to cut an Aboriginal space within the political and economic boundaries of Australia. So successful for them in this regard. Just quickly for this, there's clearly a gap. Aboriginal people seems to be committed to practice, life projects, principle and places, and this commitment gives them reasons to actions that are largely independent from financial motives. On the contrary, farmers, they clearly have some of these commitments too, but they are also heavily embedded in the market economy, so they have very heavy market commitments, and their production is basically driven by their consumption need. So overall, it seems that NRM, environmental conservation, promoted through appealing or by appealing to the farmers bottom line, hasn't been very successful overall. There's probably a gap that here need to be, thought about. Clearly, IPAs are not only a successful story. There are lots of problems. One of the major is the coordination with other government programs. closing the gap framework seems to be in direct conflict with traditional owner aspiration to stay on country and care for the country, but also the voluntary nature of this agreement doesn't require from the government any major involvement, especially in terms of changing legislation. So you have the cases of, you know, declaring an IPA doesn't extinguish mining rights. So you have IPAs that have, for 30%, for instance, in the case of the Jelk IPA, 30% of the IPAs is under a mining exploration lease. So whenever the miners wants to open a mine, they go and do it. There's also a strong case for more public money to be invested in IPAs. We should be aware that in traditional management practices or Aboriginal management practices may not be suited to address new and emerging environmental threats like weeds and feral animals. So the government should provide some skills in NRM for rangers, but also traditional owners residing in remote communities or in their traditional estates are the best place to address, to monitor, report, address emerging environmental threats. So that's another case for public investment in training in this regard. And also what it needs to be done, at least in the IPAs where I've been involved, much more non-indigenous scientific inputs to understand what's the baseline there, what are the basic environmental conditions, what has been happening. And clearly needs to train also the scientists to when they get in contact with indigenous people. The limited success of programs such as Land Care Program, but also similar programs across different countries, have kind of pushed for the search of different ways to promote conservation. And one of these tools is the payments for environmental services. Must be said that most of the push is coming from large organizations such as the World Bank. Payments for environmental services are basically born out from the simple idea that with increasing scarcity of environmental services, this could be potentially traded. So basically, environmental services buyers can make direct contractual conditional payments to landholders for them to adopt conservation measures so that, you know, there is some good environmental outcomes. And on the other side, these payments could provide some support for landowners' livelihoods. This very basic idea is payments, or PES, is one of those suites of instrument called market-based instrument. Basically, they try to address market failure by creating a market. And this is the basic, you know, features or logic behind PES. Basically, you know, most of the benefit from conservation activities do not accrue to the landowners, so the landowners benefit only marginally from conservation activities. And when these benefits from conservation are less than the benefit the landowners get from other use of the land, such as agriculture and forestry, and these use produce some negative environmental externalities, the community that suffer could pay some amount of money to the landowners so they will adopt conservation and management practices. So it's very simple. Clearly, it's simple, but there are so many problems here. First of all, if you want to use PES, there must be a market failure. So current activities should be producing negative environmental externalities that could be addressed by adopting conservation strategies. We also need to be able to identify land managers. We need to identify the beneficiaries of environmental conservation, and this beneficiary needs to be also willing to pay something. And also, implying this dollar sign is that we are able also to estimate at least a little bit the value of these services, okay? While this opportunity cost here, so the benefit from productive use of the land are quite straightforward. Usually it's very difficult to estimate, to put a dollar value to these environmental services. I believe this is very straightforward, but I believe also that it doesn't really apply to indigenous land. I think that the picture in Aboriginal held land is best described by this this slide up here. It's generally agreed that traditional owners have very little opportunity cost because the land has a very low natural fertility or because the land was previously used for agriculture and for other activities that have degraded the natural productivity of the soil. So very little opportunity cost. It's also agreed in general that traditional management practices may have a very positive effect on the environment. So where are the problems in indigenous health land coming from, the environmental problems? Where are they coming from? Well, we can argue that some of the problems are mostly related to policies, agriculture and forestry, mining, depopulation, collapse of Aboriginal traditions. We may argue what goes into this list, but I believe that most of the problems that we'll find down here are related to policy distortions. And as any economist will tell, before you address a problem with a market-based instrument, you address policy distortion. That's the first best solution. Only after you address this policy distortion, you may use PES instrument or PES type of instruments to provide economic incentive, for instance, to traditional owner to stay on the land, take care, and produce positive environmental externalities. And indeed, this is the best framework that I could find of that described the existing PES type of schemes currently operating in indigenous NRM. The first one is the Welfare Project or West Animal Land Fire Abatement Project that is basically based on an agreement between traditional owner from the Jelka and Wadakin IPAs and the Darwin Liquefied Natural Gas, brokered by the Northern Land Council and the Northern Territory Government. Under this agreement, traditional owners and indigenous rangers provide strategic fire management to reduce the number of late season high in CO2 emission fires through strategic burning early in the season, over 28,000 square kilometers in the Jelk and Wadakin IPAs. So reducing late season fire creates some carbon credit that offset the emission from the DLNG gas plant in Darwin. And for this, DLNG pays around $1 million per year for 17 years. Another example of PES type of scheme for indigenous NRM is the AQUIS fee-for-service program. Basically, AQUIS contract indigenous rangers to provide weeds and insect and illegal fishing vessel monitoring for biosecurity. AQUIS pay for a vehicle or a vessel and up to a full pay for up to two rangers per day. This program doesn't provide startup support, so if you're an indigenous rangers group that doesn't have a boat, you can't do an illegal fishing vessel monitoring or patrols. They provide some training, and the fundings also are year by year. They are not ongoing fundings. There is little data about this project, but for what I know, for instance, in Dimuru Aboriginal Corporation in Nulumboi last year, they gained around $8,000 from the AQUIS contracts, and Dimuru runs a $2 million operation, so AQUIS contracts have had little financial impact, really. And some talk with AQUIS officers basically have showed that no many indigenous rangers are interested in taking up weeds and insect monitoring. So financial incentive may not be enough. Another example of PES for indigenous NRM is the Australian Customs Indigenous Rangers Program. Basically, customs engage rangers to provide maritime surveillance and border protection. It started in 2005 as a pilot program to target illegal fishing and border protection. The Jelka Ranger were the first to enter this pilot project. They received $250,000 per year to have a boat and two rangers patrolling the coast. And since then, JELC rangers have actually intercepted several illegal fishing vessels and have provided evidence for successful prosecutions. The program was extended in 2007 to the Badajawi rangers in WA and the Arakun rangers in Queensland. I believe there are also other rangers group involved with custom on an on-off basis, basically. And the federal government in 2007 committed around $600,000. There's not much, again, about this program in terms of data available, really. Yes, so what can we say about these PAS programs for non-Indigenous rangers? Well, I believe there are some constraints for Indigenous communities and traditional owners to take up this kind of contractual commitments. First of all, the low opportunity cost imply that they have little bargaining power, negotiating power when it gets to demand money. And you need the realities that Aquis and Custom have paid very little money. They also need initial capital investment to purchase boats or vessels of any other asset that is required. And indeed, the welfare project is working because the traditional owner have had the support of a very well-funded Indigenous Rangers group and resource agency. Some training may be required. So the more complex the PE scheme, the more the training required. And I believe, in my experience, that some environmental service buyers may not be willing to provide this training, especially some federal and state agency that will have to provide enforcement, law enforcement and compliance training, and they're not really willing to relinquish some powers to give them to Indigenous rangers. PS work best when traditional management match current activities, and also is best if payments are ongoing, so because they signal a strong commitment from the buyers. And also, we have to be aware that financial incentive may not be enough. There are critical aspects that we need to consider, that market exchange through PIS implies that environmental cultural elements need to be commodified, and that could involve that we are conflicting, you know, a complex system of environmental cultural elements into a commercialized one with possible detrimental effects to the whole system. We have to be aware that PS scheme connected to offset schemes have zero effects on the environment, as in the case of the welfare project, and need to consider the overall effect on the economy. Indeed, there are studies that show that participants in PAS scheme have no gain at all because the PAS scheme was not linking properly to the local economy. And that, you know, brings to the last point here that we probably need to be creative also when we think about the form of payments of these schemes. Some concluding comments. I believe that's my opinion. Of course, Indigenous NRM have been successful so far when traditional owners have managed to cut a space of autonomy from the government and from bureaucracy. But there's also the weakness of the project. Indeed, there's nothing stopping government, the government won't be held back by the prospect of losing substantial investments when this type of Indigenous NRM don't fit into the political agenda or into the interests of more powerful economic operators. I also believe the equality and environmental conservation cannot be realized only through market mechanisms. Indeed, the economic discourse seems to be crowding out any other consideration when it comes to environmental conservation and cultural protection. And indeed, Indigenous NRM are highly dependent on policy agenda, and we need to address this policy distortion before we probably go into market-based instrument. Thanks.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.